The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu. Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. You can go beyond giving to impact. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
From WABE in Atlanta, welcome to this edition of Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Coming up on today's program,
we will build the Center for Diversion and Services in downtown Atlanta. The Diversion Center is the physical manifestation of our commitment to reforming the way we approach quality of life offenses in the city of Atlanta. Instead of criminalizing poverty, the Diversion Center will provide showers, food, laundry, behavioral health screenings, and other services to help people get back on their feet.
Atlanta Mayor Andre Dickens gives a State of the City address. In just a moment, we'll tell you what else the mayor had to say. Speaking of Atlanta, how about the long list of transit and transportation-related projects on the city's to-do list? I'll speak with City Councilman Amir Farouki about projects that remain in limbo. And the latest promise, of course, here we go, hold on. How about those potholes on DeKalb Avenue? We'll talk all about that. Also, the clock is ticking as state lawmakers grapple with mental health funding and, of special interest, funding for Georgia's respite centers. All that's coming up, but let's start with this. Keeping in tradition, Atlanta Mayor Andre Dickens delivered the 2023 State of the City Address in the early morning. Some of you were probably there. The mayor opened with what he called his top priority for the city, public safety. Dickens said homicides are 56% lower than this time last year, and he attributes the drop toward increased pay and a take-home vehicle program for patrol officers. In a related issue, the mayor said the controversial public and fire training facility in Southeast Atlanta will be built.
We need training facilities for our police and our firefighters so that the training facilities that we have been long condemned. That's why we are building the state-of-the-art Atlanta Public Safety Training Center.
In an interview with Closer Look on Friday, the mayor said he would consider or listen to other recommendations offered from a newly appointed task force. Meanwhile, back to the State of the City address, Dickens talked about breaking ground on its Center for Diversion and Services, as you just heard earlier. The facility was scheduled to open last year, but was delayed after the city council voted to lease the city jail, where the center would be temporarily located to Fulton County.
The Diversion Center is the physical manifestation of our commitment to reforming the way we approach quality of life offenses in the city of Atlanta. Instead of criminalizing poverty, the Diversion Center will provide showers, food, laundry, behavioral health screenings, and other services to help people get back on their feet.
And also, he talked about the city's recent purchase of 2 Peachtree Street, a 41-story downtown office skyscraper that will be converted to hundreds of affordable housing units. That's according to the mayor's administration. Now, on to the Georgia's General Assembly. State lawmakers have a long list of unfinished business with just one legislative day left to get in their 40-day session. That's setting up a jam-packed and potentially unpredictable sine die that we all love on Wednesday, as we hear from WABE Sam Greenglass.
With just hours of floor time left to vote on dozens and dozens of measures, the legislature spent Monday slowly ticking through bills, notably thorny bills dealing with online sports betting, mental health reform, and others have been left for the very end of session. So what explains the sluggish pace? Tensions between the House and Senate have been building over the budget and other topics, entangling other legislation in the fray. Plus, some of the most hot-button bills were already facing tenuous paths. So lawmakers are spending the time they have left whipping votes to get their priorities done or eating up time on the floor to run out the clock on bills they want to stop. Sam Greenglass, WABE News.
And state lawmakers continue to go back and forth on what changes need to be made to Georgia's medical cannabis program. 2 licensed Georgia producers are on track to get low THC oil on the market this May or June. 4 other licenses are tied up in court. Republican State Senator Matt Brass supports the latest version of legislation that passed the state Senate this week. It will be responsive to the number of patients who want the product.
Number one, and probably one of the most important things we're doing in this bill, is going and putting in a trigger for the licenses, meaning the tying those number of licenses to the number of patients on the registry.
Now, there are currently 26,000 patients on the state's low THC oil registry. In recent hearings, concerns were raised that there could be way more supply than demand. Now, lawmakers have passed legislation to allow Georgians to take time off from work to vote during early voting. It expands on the current law that allows for 2 hours of unpaid time off to vote on Election Day. The legislation expands the audits of statewide elections as well. Senate Bill 129 passed with significant bipartisan support. It now goes to Governor Brian Kemp for his signature. In other news not related to the Gold Dome, a Fulton judge is ordering the county's district attorney's office to respond to a motion from Donald Trump's legal team. Trump wants to throw out the case investigating his alleged interference in Georgia's 2020 presidential election. As Christopher Austin reports, the judge has given Fulton DA Fonnie Willis until May 1st to respond.
Trump's lawyers are asking the judge to throw out the report and all testimony from the Fulton special grand jury. And they're seeking to bar Fulton County District Attorney Fonnie Willis from continuing to investigate or prosecute Trump. The challenge filed last week by Trump's legal team also argues that Fulton Superior Court Judge Robert McBurney misinterpreted Georgia law. They're requesting a different judge, which McBurney did not address in his order. Willis's office says they will respond through court filings. Christopher Alston, WABE News.
And another major court hearing, Georgia Supreme Court is set to hear oral arguments today in a challenge to the state's abortion law. The law bans abortions once fetal cardiac activity is detected in the womb, which is roughly 6 weeks of pregnancy. As we hear from WABE's Jess Madar, she reports this week's hearing follows months of court battles over the abortion restrictions last year.
Georgia's abortion law, known as HB 481, took effect last year after the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. But attorneys representing abortion rights groups and physicians argue it's unconstitutional under the state constitution because it was initially created and passed back in 2019. When Roe was still in effect. For their part, attorneys for the state say the abortion law remains valid and should continue to stand. Now it's up to the Georgia Supreme Court to decide. Justices are expected to issue a ruling in the next few months. Jess Mador, WABE News.
DeKalb police say two people were arrested during a multi-department operation to clear out Entrenchment Creek Park. As Shemaine Cruz reports, the park is located near the controversial Atlanta Public Safety Training Center.
A massive law enforcement presence was sent out to clear the woods in South DeKalb County, where police say they found Molotov cocktails, nail boards, and several syringes filled with fentanyl. In addition to the two arrests, three people left voluntarily, and one vehicle was towed. The operation comes after DeKalb in Atlanta agreed to move forward with the nearby construction of a $90 million police and firefighter training center, and the death of an environmental activist during a similar clearing operation in January. Meanwhile, the park itself is caught up in controversy, as the county plans to swap property with a private developer. Officials say the executive order restricting access to the park will be rescinded once they determine it is safe for the public to visit. Shemaine Cruz, WABE News.
The National Weather Service says it was a powerful EF3 tornado that devastated part of central Georgia Sunday with winds as high as 150 miles an hour. That tornado blew across portions of Troop and Meriwether counties, leaving at least five people injured. Governor Brian Kemp issued a state of emergency. Kemp, First Lady Marty Kemp, and GEMA Director Chris Stallings visited the areas hit hardest by the storms Monday. Meanwhile, one state over from Georgia, over in Mississippi, the Red Cross is on site helping those affected by the storms and tornado. Hardest hit was Rolling Fork, Mississippi. And we should note if you or your organization would like to help, visit redcross.org or call 1-800-RED-CROSS. And you can also text the word Red Cross to 90999. Again, that's text the word Red Cross to 90999. You're listening to Closer Look.
Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. If you love Atlanta, you can invest in the big picture. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
And Closer Look continues from WABE in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. As mentioned earlier, Atlanta Mayor Andre Dickens touted and outlined accomplishments and initiatives the city is undertaking. One area the mayor talked about, of course, infrastructure.
I asked each of you to report potholes, and man, did you respond. Thanks to everyone who called 311 with their reports, we filled more than 10,600 potholes in Atlanta last year.
Potholes. Mayor Dickens also noted multiple sources of funding, such as $100 million in federal dollars that would be invested in roads and transit.
$750 million to rebuild our roads, our fire stations, our bike paths, and our sidewalks. Atlanta voters overwhelmingly put their trust in us, and now it's our time to deliver.
But we get emails from y'all, and y'all talk about metal covers, flattened tires, and roadways that some drivers, bikers, and pedestrians see as a safety hazard. And yes, we know that this is sometimes a good way to explain Atlanta streets. I'll ask my next guest. And there are some improvements that are long overdue. For example, the last time DeKalb Avenue was resurfaced, get this, Madonna, Michael Jackson, Bon Jovi, and Van Halen were the biggest musical acts on the charts. That should give you some indication. And there are many citywide improvements which are currently on the pause for some reason, so we'll find out why. Joining me now is Atlanta City Councilman Amir Farouki, who also serves as chair of the city's Transportation Committee. Welcome.
Thank you, Rose. It's always good to be with you.
Do you remember when Madonna and Michael and Van Halen and Bon Jovi were ruling the music?
I was in second, third, fourth grade.
So. Oh, come on.
So my teachers remember.
Why are you making me sound old? Let's begin here. First, I want to get you. You attended the Mayor's State of the City address. What were your takeaways? I'm just curious.
Yeah, it was, rightfully, I think, a positive and upbeat speech from Mayor Dickens. He's done a really good job bringing the city together and working closely with council in a very collaborative, transparent way, which has, I think, helped us tackle issues big and small in a really cohesive manner. And, we remain, as he said very emphatically, one city, which was, I think, a top priority of the council and the mayor in this new term. So he's been a very strong and steady hand on the proverbial steering wheel and excited about the future with his leadership.
With the public training facility, and I want to get to that, and we'll get to why you came, because I want to be fair, but with the public training facility, and depending on whom you ask, it's needed. It's needed, but not in this, where it's currently proposed. What are your thoughts on all this and moving forward?
Yeah, look, I just came from a lunch with a firefighter right before I came into the studio, and he reminded me fire department doesn't even have a tower to train in for mm-hmm. fire emergencies. And this proposed site and development will have that. So, my view is fundamentally, yes, both our police and fire training facilities are way outdated and we need new facilities yesterday. Mm-hmm. I think it's a fair question to have around location. Is this the best location? But one reason I voted for this coming out of Public Safety Committee 2 years ago was we spent a lot of time working on limiting the footprint of the facility so that we're mitigating impact on the forest. And in fact, reduce the acreage that the facility was going to sit on.
Sure.
And put in place a pretty rigorous tree replacement scheme so that any trees that are removed are going to get replaced and hardwood trees are going to get that are removed or replaced with 100 trees. And let's be honest, it gets lost in this. You look at Google Maps 20 years ago, much of that site was clear cut. But this will remain largely green space will become one of the largest park spaces in the city.
Okay. Let's talk transportation. When we were going over this list, of course, DeKalb Avenue comes up. Everyone always points to DeKalb Avenue. You've been on DeKalb Avenue lately?
Yeah, it's in my district. And
yeah, it is.
I'm on it frequently as much as I hate being on it. Look, DeKalb Avenue, I will say this in full frankness, it has been one of the more deflating issues that I've dealt with on council because it has needed repair and replacement for a long time previous to my now 6 years on council. My predecessor pushed for it. The money's been there. The city has been slow to procure a contractor. We now finally have one, and work is starting up right now.
Let's back up a moment because we've talked about this, and folks have come on this program and said, you know, you've had some of these projects that have been on the list even before you've been on council. And what is the process? Is it solely because you just haven't been able to get a vendor, personnel, the city? What's been the primary, the core primary holdup for these projects, the long ones, Councilman Farocki?
So I think there are a handful of variables that play into this. So I think one is, when does the money for the project come in the door, right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's rolling based on a sales tax or some other scheme that doesn't mean all the money is available all at once for every project, right? So the projects get put into a sequence based on expected revenue when revenue mm-hmm. comes in the door. So that's one. So every project's not going to start the same day. The second is the procurement process at the city can be a bit of a labyrinth and quite glacial. And sometimes that goes with not getting enough bidders who don't meet every requirement of the proposal. And that means they have to go back to the market again. And so it slows things down.
And you've all had to overhaul that department too.
Correct. With the mayor's leadership and a new chief procurement officer, they've done some really good work in streamlining the process. But those things slowed things down considerably. And then with cost increases and inflation, what may have once been a $100 million project is now all of a sudden $175 million. And so projects either get shelved or they get delayed until we find additional funding.
Separate from the more MARTA, which we will get into, how much is in the pot for these road improvements or anything related to transit and transportation that you all can deal with?
So let me just say there's a number of buckets. We have an old T-SPLOST that is still mm-hmm. finishing up. We have a new T-SPLOST that's currently called Moving Atlanta Forward that's just getting started. We have the $750 million bond, infrastructure bond, that Mayor Dickens mentioned in that clip you played. Mm-hmm. So we have, you know, upwards of $1 billion, $2 billion.
So the one from 2016, the last time that voters went to the polls to vote on SPLOST, that how much is that? Did that come to?
I don't recall.
Okay.
But let me say this. I think a lot about trust in government and trust in one another. It's in short supply. Trust in institutions is in short supply. WABE may be one of the few places where trust is actually pretty high because y'all do a balanced job, even when you give us a hard time.
You realize that's going in a promo, right?
Yeah. And, you know, having now been at City Hall for 6 years, I try everything I can in my power in my office to build trust with residents. And the thing that builds and maintains trust more than anything is doing what you say you're going to do. And I understand residents' frustrations when projects are proposed, they're funded, and then no one sees a shovel in the ground for years. It's frustrating. It's deflating. Our infrastructure needs more attention. And when we're not acting on it, people lose faith in our ability to get things done. And so I think this is a top priority for myself and other council members. I believe the mayor believes so too. So there's a renewed energy and urgency to get things done that have been promised.
How do you all prioritize this list? Is it this project has been here for 5 years, 4 years, or is it in terms of, I guess, severity, if there's a road? Because look, we make fun about DeKalb, but DeKalb is in horrible shape. Let's be really clear.
Yeah, I mean, look, well, DeKalb is the tail end of the last T-SPLOST. So that was a project that was on the 2016 T-SPLOST project list, and we're just getting to it now. There's a new project list that's being funded by a second T-SPLOST, and those projects are sequenced over the next 5 or 6 years, partially based on demand, equity, kind of immediate urgency. But there's always debates on even that because everyone wants their project done mm-hmm. first, right? But that ultimately is handicapped by when the dollars come in. So you have to sequence them over a number of years mm-hmm. based on when the revenue comes in the door.
So someone listening says, okay, but will one district be, if one district has a lot of these urgent projects and then another district may, they just need a little paving here or need to widen the sidewalk. Or I mean, look at Ponce. Ponce is getting a lot of work done.
Well, it's a state route, GOT moves a little quicker sometimes.
Well, you know what? Maybe a lot of people didn't know that. That is a good point. I'm glad you corrected
me. But your question's
that.
A good one, yeah. Right? And I will say the answer, in my experience, has been a mix of policy and politics, right? So the policy is what is equitable so that we're doing work across the city all at one time and not just in one part of town at once. What is needed and urgent? But then, you know, politics gets injected when they put a list before a council and we negotiate for our projects to try and get a little further up the timeline.
Does every project require a procurement process, or can you all do some of these within the city of Atlanta, within your I guess would be roadways and
yeah, that's a great question. Almost everything on a T-SPLOS list is done through contractors. The city doesn't always have the in-house capacity to deliver. They're building out some sidewalk and restriping capacities, but big, heavy infrastructure is done through contractors.
And how long can that take? Typically, when you put the RFP out there, I'm assuming that's the first process, and then you get bids, and then you got to go back, and then it's got to be voted on.
Yeah, it takes a long time. It can take 6 months to a year, if at the least. Yeah. And that's before you get the contractor to, you know, you award the bid, and then they're out in the field doing the work.
6 months.
And weather gets in the way. There's, you know, DeKalb Avenue is a good example of this. Weather's gotten in the way a lot. You find that there's a water main issue, so watershed has to go in and do some underground work before you can start paving.
6 months to a year. And if that's for all those projects that require a separate contractor. I know someone listening just stopped and said, wow.
And that's not to say that every procurement takes 6 months to a year. I mean, there's
okay. You know,
the city's procuring for pins and copiers and all sorts of
things. I'm not talking about that.
These bigger projects, you know, have greater scrutiny. They're more complex. The bid packages, the companies that bid for them have to put together a pretty robust bid package. That takes time. The review takes time. And sometimes you don't get enough bidders, or they come in above cost. So you have to go back to the marketplace again.
Email just said, so just get the question, Rose, when is DeKalb Avenue going to be?
So currently,
well, there you go.
I will say this with, a number of deadlines in my time on council have been blown past for DeKalb Avenue. But that was before a contractor had been selected and work had started. In short, repaving is scheduled to be complete by early fall, 2023.
I want you to say that again.
Look, this is what the Department of Transportation is telling me. Look, it's easy to yell at your council member, as you should at times, but we are the legislative branch. The executive branch where the DOT sits is charged with executing these projects. That's the timeline they have given us, and I believe they're going to hold true to it.
Let's shift for a moment and let's talk about the Moore MARTA audit. You all were very clear with MARTA that you wanted to sort of, what are you looking at the clock for? You ready to go?
I don't see how much time I have. This is a big topic.
You all were very clear with MARTA that you wanted to delve into this. I had City Council President Doug Shipman on. You have been very instrumental in this. I want to get your viewpoint on this. It's not that you all think that MARTA has not been transparent enough. You just want to see what has been designated for some of their projects strictly for Atlanta, right?
Correct.
That's what you all wanted? Okay.
Yeah. So just as quick context, in 2016, City of Atlanta voters elected to tax ourselves an extra half penny mm-hmm. on top of the penny we already pay. That half penny going specifically for MARTA expansion and enhancement in the City of Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
It was a 40-year tax expected to generate $2.7 billion in revenue. MARTA rolled out a plan that had 29 miles of light rail, 13 miles of bus rapid transit, and other improvements. To date, $371 million have been collected. $181 million of those dollars have been spent on bus enhancements and services. $181 million when, out of the $2.7 billion, we were told $238 million would be spent on buses. So they've almost exhausted that bucket for bus service. So that's 49% of the dollars that had been spent on bus service and enhancement. That raised some questions with council. No one is opposed to bus service, including bus rapid transit in the city. Buses are a quick and efficient way of moving folks around. But it seems like voters' expectations rightfully were for some heavy infrastructure transit expansion. And that hasn't happened yet. We have not seen shovels on the ground. And so we felt like an audit was appropriate, and MARTA has agreed.
And so is it an outside auditor that you all agree on, or will this be someone from the city of Atlanta, or
The legislation is proposed would allow the city's finance department to select an auditor to do the work. Currently, what is happening is the mayor's office is working closely with MARTA to hash that out, so I think we'll know more in the next week or so.
And based on what you find, and you already mentioned that, look, 49% of that going to bus, you think that that's a lot.
Yeah. It's not just me who thinks that a lot.
No, that's what I mean. Yeah, you all think.
Most of Atlanta thinks that's a lot.
But at this point, what can you do? Because you can't tell them to scale back, or can you?
Well, I think there's a few questions that an audit would answer, which is of the dollars being spent on bus service and enhancement of bus service, how much is going to really supporting bus operations that existed before the tax? And mind you, these are dollars spent on bus service at a time when ridership plummeted due to the pandemic. It's now coming back up. The other thing I think it will answer is how many dollars are being spent on consultants? I think there's a trend across transit agencies in this country that more and more projects have inflated costs because so much money is being spent on outside consultants. And I think voters have a right to know how much is being spent there.
The Beltline obviously is a big part of that because people talk about light rail, obviously the streetcar. You were on council, correct, when the streetcar initially started running, correct? Weren't you on council, or had you?
The downtown streetcar.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was operating before I joined city council.
Was that a good idea? Was that a good investment for Atlanta?
It's a fair question to ask because the current streetcar as it exists today does not serve many folks. It doesn't work at a frequency that's helpful. You can walk faster where you need to go than wait for the streetcar to come.
What, 2 miles?
However, if you look back to the origins of it, it was originally planned to be a streetcar up and down Peachtree Street when the federal dollars were awarded. The thinking was let's build this downtown loop that would then feed into a north-south Peachtree Street line. That has not been resuscitated. And I think now much of the thinking is how do you take the existing streetcar and expand it east-west to create some above-ground connectivity east-west across the city.
And we should note, to be fair, that money was federal funding. Not much.
Largely.
So do you see it expanding, being able to expand and really become a viable option for folks? Because you're right, you don't see a lot of people riding it. I mean, it's about 2 miles either way, right? Or total?
Right.
Currently?
Yeah. I mean, it's largely today a loop between the Central Olympic Park community and the MLK Historic District, right? So it's a fair question. I think that the challenge to transit is twofold. One is how do folks work and live their lives in the next 10, 20 years? It's a bit of a moving target. The other kind of alternatives that didn't exist 10, 15 years ago, like rideshare and somewhat affordable alternatives, not for everyone. But we need transit to move people around. I think the question that we have to answer trying to hit the target in the future and today is what technology and modes of transit do we need in a major American city?
What do you think Atlanta needs more of?
We certainly need more bus rapid transit. It's, when done well, a cheap and flexible and effective mode of moving people quickly. Cheaper than light rail, cheaper than heavy rail.
Of course.
In a dedicated lane, it works really well where it's done well. And there's a number of projects that will be oncoming on board that will be those types of BRT projects. I think there's probably new technologies every transit agency should be looking at, whether it's some form of rideshare to compete mm-hmm. with the Ubers and the Lyfts of the world to make their product more attractive. There's probably autonomous vehicles and shuttles that can work in fixed and safe locations alongside existing heavy rail and bus mm-hmm. service.
I have a comment from a listener here with a question. It says, I like that council is putting pressure on MARTA to deliver, but what about ATL dot work like Peachtree Shared Space that even had funding from the ARC tied to it? Will the council put more pressure on ATL dot for transparency on these city projects? That's a good question.
Yeah, I think council has put significant pressure on the Department of Transportation at the city and the mayor's office to deliver projects, to be transparent about cost overruns or cost increases. And we feel like we've gotten straight and clear answers, as hard as it may sometimes be to say, we thought we were going to get 20 projects, now we can mm-hmm. only do 15. Those are hard conversations to have, both at City Hall and with the public. But there's never been a sense that we haven't been able to understand why projects are sluggish or being reduced. So I push back on that sentiment a little bit, because if you listen to a Transportation Committee meeting, there's just as much pushback and challenging questions to the city's Department of Transportation on T-SPOS projects as there has been with MARTA.
So I want to make sure we're clear, too, with this on light rail. You support light rail on the Beltline? You think that can still be can it work? Yes, people have said, yes, it can work. Can it be built? I guess is another question.
So I support transit on the Beltline. You know, the technology that works best, I think, is a fair question for debate. Oftentimes, the transit conversation is, do you build it and they come? Mm-hmm. Or do you wait till folks are there and then you build it? And here on the east side, there's enormous population and work density. The chicken has laid the proverbial egg. It is ripe for transit.
The other side to that is folks will say, because of what has already happened on the east side, maybe it would be better than to, this is some people's opinions, just instead of the light rail, make one area for the folks on wheels, your bikers and your scooters. And I'm not going to go on an anti-scooter rant because I'll get an email, because goodness, they're all over the place. Have we come to a place now where maybe if it's not going to be light rail, do we do that, so we break it up so everyone can enjoy it? We all love the Beltline, but goodness, we know it's crowded. Yep. Were you out there this past weekend? A little rough. It was like Indy 500 for a moment.
I live not far from the East Side Trail, and frankly, on many weekends on a sunny, beautiful day, I avoid it because it's so crowded, right? It's a success story because of that. And I've heard that same solution proposed.
Is it a success story because it's crowded?
Look, the Beltline has been attractive to so many people.
Sure.
Because I think it has filled a void in this city, which is really inspiring and accessible public space. We are not a city that has traditionally had great public spaces where you can be next to your neighbor, eating next to a stranger, listening to a performance. I mean, it is in a city that we spend most of our time in our cars, for many of us, I think people are hungry for public spaces that make you feel part of a community in a big city, and the Beltline does that.
It's a great public space, but it also was designed, in terms of the visionary, and correct if I'm wrong, that it was going to be transit,
sure,
too.
You could, they're not mutually exclusive. You can have great public space and also be a transportation corridor.
So light rail? Yeah?
Yeah, I think it can work, but it's going to have to work all around the Beltline. And I think it is a fair question to ask, whether this light rail expansion is the right one at this time, or if it should be going west, or do you wait until the entire Beltline is complete before you then do light rail? These are all fair questions. MARTA is far enough down the planning for this east side streetcar extension, including putting tens of millions of dollars into the engineering and the planning phase, that is likely to go forward. I think that if the cost of it right now, set at about $230 million, proves to be insufficient for covering the cost, you're going to have a different conversation. And the MARTA board's got to figure that out pretty soon.
That's the cost for the light. That's the estimated cost for the extension. Okay.
Yeah. But that doesn't include maintenance and continued operation, which is another bucket of future costs.
Beltline is scheduled to be completed 2030 still on track? Is that why I'm here? You think that's going to happen?
Yeah, I think that's another success story of philanthropic, civic, city collaboration to get and federal support from our senators and representatives to find the funds to build out and the Beltline. That is happening at the rate it should be.
So, Councilman, as we wrap up, how do you define when we talk about this city and having what is or should be considered a complete and equitable transit and mobility type of city? You know, if you had to, maybe a grade is not fair. I don't know, ABC, maybe we're 60% of the way, however you want to assess that and whatever metrics you want to use. But where are we? And I know because we have so many different neighborhoods that you'll get a different answer. I'm going to ask you that.
Yeah, I think for Atlanta to be a truly successful city, it needs to have a transportation infrastructure and ecosystem that when you walk out of your door and you're trying to get to school or to work or to dinner, you can walk, you can bike, you can catch the bus, you can catch light rail. Obviously, different parts of the city are designed differently, and some will be more car dependent than others. But you should be able to get from one side of the city to the other, no matter how much money you make, in about any mode you can choose to move. And we're not there yet. We're a long way from it. We don't have the right bike infrastructure. Our sidewalks continue to require repair and expansion. Our roads, as you noted and the mayor noted, need a lot of work. I'll note very quickly, though, that the city of Atlanta, 500,000 folks or so, is a much bigger city than that because folks come in every day and put wear and tear on our infrastructure. And most of the cost of that is borne on the backs of the 500,000 or so folks who live in the city. And so we're playing catch up constantly. And that's a challenge we have to tackle.
And in order to achieve that, it's going to take more than just talking about the city. Here comes this P word, political will. Is this a political issue? Is this a partnership issue?
So I think it's all of those things. I would say, going back to my opening comments, we have to ask folks to contribute to support multimodal infrastructure. But in order to ask folks to tax themselves for that infrastructure, we have to deliver the projects that we promise now. And if you don't deliver those projects, it's really hard to go back to folks and say, hey, you need to chip in more money to fix more sidewalks and build more roads.
And I know you pay attention to social media. Folks have said, I'm not going to vote for another SPLOST again until I see something. So you can understand that.
Yeah, 100%. I like that sentiment rings true as it should. I mean, government is here, in my opinion, to make folks safe and to make folks' lives easier and to let people live the lives they want to live. And when you're making that difficult on people, trust erodes. And so we have an obligation to deliver these transportation projects professionally, well, and as soon as possible.
And I want to be very clear, because you are now on record about DeKalb Avenue being completed in the fall of 2023.
I'm just parroting what the ATL DOT puts on their website. You act like I created the calendar. this is the position of the Atlanta Department of Transportation. I have talked with them. They've held public meetings about it. I believe that it will get done this year. And if not, we will share we'll share tears over it.
And if it does, we'll have a big block party. Not on the street, because we just got paid, but maybe somewhere else.
Yeah. A block party that should have happened 5 years ago, but I'll be there with you, Rose.
Atlanta City Councilman Ramir Farocki, as always, thank you for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Rose. It's always great to be with you.
How's that two-year-old?
He has a birthday next week.
All right. Thank you. Closer Look continues from WABE in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. We know that there are rates of depression and anxiety and other conditions related to one's mental health. We know that all skyrocketed during the pandemic. And we know that mental health resources in Georgia, well, this state has had to come a long way, still a long way to go. And the state also has 5 respite centers. They have become so necessary. And while the respite centers in Decatur, Augusta, Cartersville, Moultrie, and Cleveland offer free food and overnight services, the cost of running those programs, well, it's not free. With one day to go until the end of Georgia's legislative session, talks are still underway about what overall mental health funding is going to include in the budget. And that's a big question, which is there enough time to get everything in the legislation voted on and approved? And we should note that we were going to be joined by Georgia's longtime Democratic State Senator Nan Orrock, who is on Georgia's Senate Appropriations Committee. Senator Orrock was called away for some other hearings related to funding. So we're going to welcome back Chris Johnson, the interim executive director of the Georgia Mental Health Consumer Network. Chris, welcome back. You've been following the budget talks, and right now they're still talking about this, but something jumped out to you because there was some funding that was initially that would strip funding for some of these respite centers. Tell our listeners what you came across, what you discovered.
Well, what we discovered was that the funding that was originally provided to us at the Georgia Mental Health Consumer Network to fund the operating centers was cut. It received a cut, a COVID cut, we called them back in 2021, with everyone else who received a cut, right? And we took fair lumps, you know, and we made it through. And one of the ways we made it through was that the funding for the respite centers and our other programs was restored. Now, it was restored unbeknownst to us with what are called federal COVID dollars, right? Those were short-term funds. Before the cuts, we received those funds in state dollars, like state of Georgia dollars that are renewed annually, and also federal block grant dollars, which are just sort of there. You know, once you get them, you get them. But now when the funds were restored, they were restored with those federal COVID dollars, and we didn't know that. We didn't know that until December of 2022, so just a couple months back. And when we found that out, we found that out for fiscal year 2023, that the federal funds were gone and that our budget for 23 was being reduced, like mid-year in real time. And so we went and we talked to a bunch of people, and we got those funds, like temporarily, like from the state. The state found enough money like to sort of get us through the end of the fiscal year 23, which we're in now. But for fiscal year 24, they said, you're going to need to go to the legislature and get this fixed if you want these funds back. So that's what we did. And we talked to the Senate Appropriations Chair on the House side, Katie Dempsey. She was fantastic. She and her staff understood what happened. And they understood also, since we were coming to them with this need, that we needed to ask for more funds than had been cut because we hadn't received a budget increase for funding the centers and these other projects in like years, like literally like a decade for some of them. And so we asked for all the funding we needed to be able to run these programs properly. And the Senate rejected the amount that was put forward by the House Appropriations Committee. Instead of $2.7 million, they gave us zero. And if that is what comes out of conference committee, and we don't know yet, we haven't seen, we're very eager, a couple of the centers will have to close.
So you were all were looking, hoping to get $2.7 million for these five respite centers. And in the revision or whatever, it was going to be cut to zero funding?
Right. In the like the Senate's first budget draft that they put forward, that they returned back to the House, they put $0 and indicated that we should go back to operate what we've been operating on. Running a deficit essentially for the state, funding some of these programs going back years, and we just can't do that anymore.
And Chris, remind our listeners who may not recall when you were on last time, talk about the types of services that you all provide at these respite centers, which is cost free for individuals.
Right. And then the respite centers, one of the things they do is they meet people where they are in the community, right? So wherever we are, the five different communities around the state, we help people there connect, and not just connect to services, but connect to people, connect to humanity itself. I mean, when you are many people who were in state hospitals and now live in their communities, live on Social Security, disability, and other types of assistance, you know, that's enough to live on, but it's not enough to have a life with. But you can't go to the movies every night. You can't go out to dinner with the folks at your church all the time. It's like, you know, it's like you're limited. And this gives a place where people can go and also like Be Well. There are recovery wellness opportunities there like every day. And not just like, you know, groups where you, talk about your feelings, but where you learn practical skills, where you can help you like find a job if you want to work, and like whatever it is you want to do in your life. We have resources there to help people connect you with those things.
So you're also providing wraparound services in addition to with the mental health check for some people. They just sometimes just need to disconnect and have a place to sort of work on themselves. So you offer wraparound services.
Well, I mean, we're part of the continuum of care for sure. We don't have any clinical services. We're like no doctors, no nurses, no clinicians. Because, you know, some people have been traumatized by the system itself, right? You know, like especially if you've been involuntarily hospitalized, like a lot of people have, you know, that experience itself is very traumatic. So you may not ever want to see the inside of like a clinic again. Right, so our settings are entirely residential. We're in residential neighborhoods. We're in houses that have been like, you know, made into centers. They're not, you know, anything like what people think of as like, you know, a public health clinic.
And
it's just not like that.
And Chris, if you all have to make the decision to close some centers, how will you go about making that decision? Which centers will you have to shutter?
I think, you know, we'll definitely be looking at what it costs to operate a center. And historically, of course, Decatur is our most expensive center because Decatur is expensive. You know, all the roads notwithstanding, you know, it's a great place to live. And it's a great place to be, but it's expensive there. We've been paying the same rent for a number of years, and we are grateful for that. But it's still an expensive center to operate. And we'll also just be looking at productivity, like where is the most good being. And at the same time, where are there fewer services? Because, you know, even if we're not doing the most good in a community, if we're one of the few resources they have there, we for sure like are going to want to stay there. It's going to be an incredibly tough decision to make.
And Chris, is the funding that you all receive, the primary bulk of it comes from the state. Are there any other avenues, any other resources that you all can maybe go to help close this funding gap?
Well, I mean, we are, and there is, but when we talk to like counties, because, you know, definitely like counties see the value and the benefit in these for sure, because it means fewer people in the emergency rooms, fewer people calling 911, fewer people using EMS, you know, just like when we put a center in a town, like, you know, they see reduction in services. You know, DeKalb County's full court press basketball, they invite us each year because like we're such a part of making their drug court successful. But when people see that the state is funding these as part of its approach to the settlement agreement with the Department of Justice, and that these are provided as evidence that the state is providing community-based services, the other partners, stakeholders are like, why should we pay for what the state is receiving the benefit of? And we don't see it that way at all. We see it as the state supporting the people that are in there.
Well, Chris, here's a question. You know, with one day to go, obviously until the end of Georgia's legislative session, you know, the talks are still underway about the overall mental health funding to what's going to be included in this budget. How optimistic are you? Have you been able to hear anything from lawmakers?
We're hopeful, and we always stay hopeful. Even when we get told no, when the door gets slammed in our faces, we stay hopeful because that's just how we operate as an organization. We know that we're doing the right thing. We know that lawmakers know what the right thing to do in this case is. You know, we have a budget surplus. We have an incredible need for all of these services that we provide. And we know that there's an incredible need because the state asked us to do them and the state committed to pay for them. And we just want the state to honor that commitment to us, to the communities, and to the people who need these services.
So tomorrow, will you just be watching, or today as well? I mean,
we're calling everybody we know all the time.
Yeah.
We are desperate for information. Yes, ma'am.
All right. Chris, we hope that you get the information that you are wanting to keep these respite centers open because you all do so much. And again, we should let folks know they are in Decatur, Augusta, Cartersville, Moultrie, and Cleveland Avenue, and Cleveland, Georgia, excuse me.
Yeah.
How soon? Go ahead.
Sorry, I just wanted to say, you know, we also operate a toll-free warm line 24 hours a day where anyone can call and get support just for getting through the day, just connecting with another person. It's 888-945-1414. You can also find out more about the centers, because we're going to have at least some centers open at the end of this year. And, you know, we want people to know they're there and to use them.
All right. Chris Johnson, the interim executive director of the Georgia Mental Health Consumer Network. Chris, thank you so much for taking the time and coming back on our program and giving us an update. We really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
And that's it for this edition of Closer Look. Our producers are LaShawn Hudson and Daniel Razel. Our supervising producer is Tiffany Griffith. Our engineer is Soria Vanderwerth. A reminder to let us know your thoughts on today's program or any other. Send me an email, rose@wabe.org. Again, that's rose@wabe.org. And if you missed any of today's program, it is always online at wabe.org/closerlook. And of course, you can listen to Closer Look weeknights at 7 p.m. as well as in our podcast. So subscribe to Closer Look wherever you like, and make sure you stay tuned to 90.1 WABE. And also, with Sine Die coming up tomorrow, our WABE politics reporters and our whole team of WABE news reporters will have the latest as we get close to Sine Die, and of course, what happens after that. So stay tuned to 90.1 WABE Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gold Dome Scramble podcast is now Plugged In, a WABE politics podcast. New name, same in-depth, on-the-ground reporting from us, WABE politics reporters Sam Greenglass and Raul Bally. We'll cover local, state, and national politics as we go beyond the headlines with journalists, voters, and politicians. New episodes drop Fridays starting April 26th. Listen and subscribe at WABE.org or your favorite podcast platform.